True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
What kind of man does he strike you as?
He was very manipulative. He manipulated the benefit system. He manipulated the women. He certainly controlled the women. There was no doubt in my mind about that. He had plenty of latent aggression in him and a lot of pent-up anger. There's plenty the welfare state can be blamed for. It can be blamed for allowing him to be work-shy. It can be blamed for enabling him to live the life that he lived solely on benefit and living off the rest of us, and for the fact that he had two children a year and the state just went on meekly paying out and out. It can be blamed for all of that. What it cannot be blamed for is the deaths of those children. That was due solely to Mick Philpott's wickedness and recklessness.
This is a man who should have been locked away for a lot longer before, when in the 1970s he stabbed his girlfriend 17 times and then attacked her mother.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Mick Philpott lived off of welfare benefits. He had been unfaithful and violent towards women throughout his adult life. His reckless and selfish plan to frame an ex-girlfriend for leaving him would result in the death of 6 innocent children. A father of 17 children, Philpott lived with 2 women and once appeared on a daytime talk show to demand a bigger government house for his oversized family. But beyond the caricature of a welfare parasite, Philpott exposed a much more dangerous stereotype, a control freak whose violence towards women went on for more than 30 years. For Philpott, women were his domestic, sexual, and childbearing slaves, and his children were evidence of his own virility. This was a man who knew no shame and used everyone, including his own children, to get what he wanted. So join us today for Shameless, Mick Philpott.
So this beer is a British beer, obviously. I just want to mention that it was sent to me from Christine, my new girlfriend. She sent me a bunch of beers from the British Isles.
Well, that's the way to your heart.
It certainly is. I think I'm in love.
Okay.
Anyway, this beer is Old Peculiar by T&R Theakston Limited in Masham, England. It's an old ale. Very pretty looking beer. Dark brown with some red highlights. Nice coloring. Very teeny head. Good aroma of caramel and toffee. A little bit of dark fruit. And this translates into the taste of caramel and toffee. Some raisins. A little bit of cherry. And a hint of peat. That little smokiness that you love so much.
Yeah, not a fan.
Medium bodied. Very nice beer.
Okay.
Thanks, Christine.
I'll try it anyway. Let's open it up.
Okay, take it on down here.
All right, on down to the quiet end. I'm going to let you start out our conversation. This is an interesting one. I think you'll enjoy this conversation.
It is an interesting one, that's for sure. So whenever a woman challenged Mick Philpott or failed to live up to his expectations, he attacked. And even on one occasion, lashing out when a girlfriend gave birth to a boy instead of the girl that he'd wanted. His determination to completely control women was revealed when he was only 19 years old. He thought that his 15-year-old girlfriend, Kim Hill, was wearing a dress that was way too short. So he was enraged that she might be attracting other men, and he shot her with a crossbow. That's a little extreme.
That's really extreme.
She survived.
Scary. She did survive.
Then another time, he hammered one of her knees.
These are all really bad signs.
Yeah, I think we're going to ditch that guy.
He was an abuser.
Yes, and like most abusive men, he was good at finding young, vulnerable victims and persuading them that they were to blame for their own abuse. Philpott could be the life of the party and come across as a friendly, good-natured guy.
Well, he charmed Kim, so she always forgave him and even agreed to marry him. But after 2 years of his attempts to kill her self-esteem and control her, Kim had had enough. She waited until he returned to his unit in the army, and she sent him a Dear John letter. This was the summer of 1978. It seemed like a safe time to escape him while he was stationed miles away. But Philpott went AWOL. He broke into her home in the early morning, stabbing her 26 times. When her mom intervened, he stabbed her 11 times. Later, he would tell a friend that he had planned to damage all of Kim's major organs. And he did cause lifelong damage to Kim. The knife perforated both of her lungs, her liver, her bladder, and one of her kidneys. So it could have easily killed her.
It sounds like. She must have been hospitalized for a while. So, and as they tried to save Kim's life, Philpott reportedly told paramedics, "You're wasting your time with that one. She's a goner." She actually did stop breathing, but she was resuscitated. He was charged, convicted, and given 7 years for attempted murder. And he served less than four. Then he was a free man. See, you know, I still will not get used to other countries' justice systems. 7 years for all that.
I know, right?
And he served four. Or less than four.
It seems just light. It really does.
Yeah, you know, I think on the one hand, our justice system is over the top in terms of sentencing. But here we've got this really lenient sentence.
Well, to me, it's all about violence. If it's stealing, you know, if it's taking property, destroying property, stealing property, that can be bad. But I don't think you need to give massive amounts of time for that. You need to think more about rehabilitation. But when you're talking about violence like this, I really feel like you need to be much more severe in your punishment. And I do think that's very light, yeah. Especially considering his attitude at the time.
The attitude, but also, and it wasn't just his girlfriend, Kim, it was her mother. So he tried to kill two people.
Mm-hmm.
And he got 7 years. Yikes.
It's a brutal attack.
Yeah.
And that's after he had abused her before as well.
Yeah, there's a pattern.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I already don't like this guy.
No, you're not going to like him at all. For the next two decades, Philpott continued to intimidate and manipulate women. He married Pamela Lomax in 1986. They had three children. He was verbally abusive and controlling, but she was too afraid to leave. Philpott cheated on her repeatedly. She even found him in their bedroom more than once with one of his teenage lovers. Now, she was secretly relieved when he left her for someone else. It was like good riddance at that point.
Then his next long-term love interest was a girl named Heather Kehoe. Uh-huh. She was only 14 when he met her and just 15 when he had sex with her for the first time.
Well, and when he did, she had never had sex before. So this was the first time she'd had sex. She was only 15.
Yep. The couple moved in together in Nottinghamshire just after Heather turned 16. She was pregnant right away and gave birth to a son. Now, Philpott decided that he liked his women to bear him lots of offspring because he saw this as proof of his virility. He said that condoms ruined sex for him.
So he's really very much a pig.
He certainly is.
I mean, do you have any insight into this personality type?
Well, other than narcissism, right? I mean, that'd be the first thing that jumps into my mind.
Misogyny?
Probably.
Mm-hmm. Heather gave birth to a second son, but Philpott became enraged at that point and hit her because this is the time when he wanted a daughter, and he wasn't happy about that. Never mind that it's the man who determines the sex of the baby, and of course she had no control over it.
No, but, you know, somebody like Philpott, that wouldn't matter at all to him.
No, and he's very ignorant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, he'd been really charming and funny when he was grooming Heather to become his lover, but once she was isolated from her family, he just dropped that whole facade of being a kind human being, and he began slapping her and throwing her around. He used to throw her out into their back garden, which is their backyard for us American types. It was freezing out there, but she was too frightened to go back inside if he threw her out. So sometimes she would sleep in an old grungy outhouse out there.
Yuck.
Yeah. Worrying about her babies at the same time who were inside with this monster. Although I guess he always seemed like he was good to the kids, which is something we'll get into. Neighbors did see her bruises and her black eyes, but Heather herself refused to admit that she was a domestic abuse victim. And this is not at all unusual.
No, we've heard that time and time again.
Yeah. She was blaming herself. I mean, she was just a kid, really, when she got involved with him.
Yeah.
And he knew how to pick women who didn't come from the most supportive families and were kind of lost and needed love. so he knew what he was doing. When she threatened to leave him, he held a knife to her throat, and he told her what had happened to Kim when she had left him, and that something like that would happen to her. One day when he'd thrown her out into the garden, she leapt over the fence and just literally ran away. He swore that he'd take their children from her, but after a lengthy custody battle, she did win. And eventually Philpott moved on to the next girl.
So, and there was a variety of girlfriends and children that followed this. In 2000, he moved in with 19-year-old Marae Duffy and Dwayne, her infant son from a previous relationship. Now, at this time, he was 44, so just a little 25-year-old age difference. Not too bad. Marae had been abused by a previous boyfriend, and she believed that Philpott was her Prince Charming. He told her that she could never use birth control. He had 7 brothers and sisters, he said, and he wanted to start a large family of his own. He also liked to keep his women pregnant, as this made them less attractive to other men and more reliant on him. Soon, Marae was pregnant with his child. I mean, what kind of a... less attractive to other men and more reliant on him. It fits him to a T, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? I mean, the deep-seated insecurities that he's covering up with this act are just very obvious, right?
Absolutely.
In 2001, he began an affair with another young single mother. This was 16-year-old Lisa Willis, and she was an orphan, so she literally had no family. Within a month, he had moved her into the council house that he shared with Marae. So a council house is like the British version of public housing. And I don't know if that means that the government paid for it 100%, or if you got your benefits and you paid a certain percentage for the house, but it was supported housing.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the very least, we can say it was discounted, right?
Very much so, yeah. Yes. And it was a house. I mean, it wasn't a palace, but it was a decent-looking place. I think it had 3 bedrooms. But, you know, once he had so many kids, of course it was small. But he was making no effort to get a job or earn, in any way, the support of these kids. In May 2003, he married Marae. And it was a big wedding. She wore a formal white wedding gown with a white veil, and Philpott wore a gray morning suit. And he was really the life of the party. Lisa, who was 7 months pregnant with his child already, was looking kind of happy to be the bridesmaid. Now, I can't imagine that she really was happy, but she went along with it, smiled, and participated. Philpott told her that he would later divorce his wife and marry her, and that way both women could have his last name. Yeah, so that's the plan.
Yeah, this 16-year-old orphan has nothing else going. She probably is happy, at least convincing herself that she's happy.
Well, yeah, and I mean, she's part of a family here.
Right, and she's got a house.
And from what I could take from it, Marae and Lisa were quite close. So it was probably like having a big sister or a mother figure in her as well.
Exactly.
But it didn't seem to faze him if he had both of these women pregnant.
Well, again, it just proves his virility. What a big stud man he is.
Yeah, you're right. Made him feel like a big man.
Yep. So years went by with one or both women pregnant most of the time. And despite being abusive and controlling to Marae and Lisa, most people in the neighborhood and others that were friends with the Philpotts thought that he was a good father who spent time with his kids and showed them plenty of affection. One of his sisters, Charmaine, told a reporter that the children adored their dad and followed him around as if he was God. He read to them, taught the older ones to play pool, and installed the jungle gym, trampoline, and swimming pool in the yard. He took some of them fishing. He played football and other games with them. Football meaning soccer.
Yeah, right.
He bought a minibus, and he was the one who took them to school in the mornings and picked them up in the afternoon.
So he was like a full-time dad.
Mr. Dad.
And both of the women did work to make some more money besides just the state assistance.
Yeah, but he didn't work.
No, never. Now, he also drove the women back and forth to work, pretty much to keep an eye on them and so he could have the car. But he refused to let them have their own door keys or their own bank accounts. Both of their paychecks were direct deposited into an account that he alone could access. He also had welfare benefits for the children, and those were paid to him directly as well. So he's got this set up just the way he wanted it. He added a large room to their council house, and he set up games with a full-size snooker table, pool table. Then he parked a camper in the yard, and this he used as a place to have sex with Lisa and Mairead on alternate nights. The women became close in this dysfunctional environment. Mairead confided in Lisa that she'd been abused when she was younger, so that's no surprise.
No.
She was actually outgoing and talkative while she worked her job as a hospital housekeeper, but became very quiet when she was home and around Philpott. And she focused all of her energy on taking care of the kids. Lisa learned early on not to talk back to Philpott. He was the one that would make all of the big decisions in the home, and he did lose his temper easily, if not with the children, at least with the women. But everyone would say that Lisa was his favorite, and he often referred to her as his queen and his princess. I think she was the prettier of the two.
Well, she's the younger of the two.
Yes, but I also think she was the kind of prettier, a little more outgoing, and she'll be the one that will kind of grow out of this and decide she doesn't want to be with him. And that will bring on this tragedy.
In 2007, Philpott was on the Jeremy Kyle program, along with Lisa and Mairead, on a show titled Father to 15, Wife and Girlfriend Pregnant Again.
So this, I think, is a lot like Jerry Springer. I looked it up on YouTube. It's one of these sensationalized daytime talk shows.
Anything for some salacious material.
It was very salacious, and Kyle was like calling him out on things. They were arguing. Not the kind of show I enjoy watching.
Now the children came with them, and they were entertained backstage by the show staff. Kyle told Philpott that he should find a job. But then he complimented him on his children, saying that they were all well-dressed and well-behaved.
Well, and they really did seem like good kids.
They did. And other people would agree that the children were doing well in school, and there was no involvement with social services. The Philpotts had a roast dinner every Sunday. They invited Mick's mother to eat with the family. She did not share Mick's aversion to work and hadn't retired from her factory job until she was 70.
Yes, I don't know where he got this idea.
Well, he figured out how to game the system, that's all.
Well, during his slot on the Kyle show, Mick Philpott obviously loved being the center of attention. He claimed that he wasn't lazy or taking advantage of the welfare system, saying that his job was caring for his kids. He bragged that he had what most men wanted in their lives, two young women to have sex with. So that was the main thing he was focusing on. And he claimed that they were a happy family. Both women agreed with him, but it seemed like he had really coached, at least Mairead. Philpott hoped the appearance would help him get a bigger council house because they only had the 3-bedroom one. But instead, he received hate mail. People got outraged. And you can see why. I mean, the public is learning that their taxes were being used to finance his lifestyle.
Yeah, and he was doing nothing. I mean, maybe you could give him some slack if he had been a hard-working guy trying to do everything he could to support the family. But he wasn't.
Well, and he wasn't even stopping having children. You know, if he stopped at some point and was raising the children, it could almost be forgiven. But then we're overlooking the whole way that he was treating women.
Well, we are.
He was a monster.
He was.
So that's a whole other thing. But the children began being bullied at school after that, after they were on the show. And the women were criticized for sharing one man between them and continuing to have his children. They became more defensive and they withdrew more from their friends at work. So they got even quieter, which now they're becoming even more victimized by him.
Exactly.
Which he just loves that, I would imagine. So it's really quite a mess. Now, what's different between this and the Mormons who have several wives? Do you see any difference there?
Well, that's not present-day Mormonism. That's...
No, but there are some that practice this.
Well, but that's not the mainstream Mormon message.
No, I'm not saying the mainstream. I'm saying the Mormons that have polygamy. like the Jeffries.
Well, I think the only difference would be how much the head of the family is willing to work.
Okay, but you could say that in that environment, the men don't necessarily do a lot of work. They might just be like the reverend, and then all their wives do actual labor. So there is a similarity there.
Oh, there probably is. But I think for the most part, the polygamists are working people, at least working more than Mick Philpott.
So there you lose the whole outrage of the tax dollars being used is the only difference you're saying.
Right.
Okay. Well, let's take a short break here for our sponsors.
Okay. Today's show is sponsored by ADT, Real Protection. When it comes to something as important as your family's safety, you deserve real protection from ADT.
For me, Real Protection means the nation's number one smart home security provider is standing by and is there for you when you need them. Real Protection means having a safe and smart home with everything from video doorbells, surveillance cameras, smart locks, lights, carbon monoxide and smoke detectors, in a system that's custom designed to fit your lifestyle.
And setting up custom automations to do things like lock the doors and set the thermostat when you leave. Real Protection means staying safe on the go, in the car, or when your kids are at school. With the ADT Go app and SOS button, Real Protection means 18,000 employees safeguarding you.
And Real Protection means direct connections with first responders. There are enough unknowns in life, so why not let ADT make home security a sure thing for you? No matter how you define safety for you, your family, or your business, ADT is there.
ADT, Real Protection. Visit ADT.com/podcast to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
And I want to tell you about how we found the most incredible, delicious cupcakes. Baked by Melissa Cupcakes. They arrived at our home in beautiful packaging, totally gift-ready, with pink and red hearts for Valentine's Day. But we couldn't wait for February 14th.
That's true. We had a little Super Bowl party and served them. They look great on the table, but they sure didn't last long. These mini bite-sized treats are just as you would find in a New York City bakery, and they're just as tasty, too. They were definitely a hit.
Yeah, they were. Baked by Melissa's Cupcakes will change the way that you think about Valentine's Day gifting forever. Every cupcake is stuffed, iced, and topped by hand. Also, they are perfectly bite-sized, so you can eat one in every flavor, guilt-free, which you will absolutely want to do. The lineup of varieties includes special flavors for Valentine's Day, including red velvet, strawberry, vanilla cream, and more.
So this Valentine's Day, send your loved ones the perfect gift with Baked by Melissa. Just remember, the last day for shipping for Valentine's Day delivery is February 12th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time.
Go to bakedbymelissa.com/brewery today. Sign up and use the promo code BREWERY to get 15% off your next order. This is a special offer exclusively for podcast listeners, so make sure you take advantage of it. That's 15% off at bakedbymelissa.com/brewery using our promo code BREWERY.
Mick Philpott apparently preferred this negative attention to no attention at all. And he started giving newspaper and television interviews, inviting strangers into the family home. He bragged about his two women, his many offspring, and his stay-at-home life. He also appeared in a show about the benefits culture in which MP Ann Widdecombe found him a job. But he never showed up for work. Big surprise there, huh?
Yeah.
So Widdecombe found that despite working and being entitled to child benefits, neither Mairead nor Lisa knew how much money came into the household each month. Philpott received it all, and he alone decided how to spend it.
Well, Widdecombe and Philpott really bashed heads when she tried to empower Mairead and Lisa. He became very angry, calling women bitches and trying to physically intimidate Widdecombe. He had an obvious hatred of women, but Philpott still wanted to have sex with new women, and he would go out and pick up women in the pub, even if he was out with Mairead and Lisa. He readily admitted in an interview that he'd been unfaithful to both of them. So he really knows no shame. I just have to wonder what his family thinks about this. It has to be embarrassing.
One would think, right?
Right.
Although his mother probably thinks he's a special son.
That could be part of the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 2011, he and Maraid took up dogging in the nearby woods. Do you know what that is?
I'd never heard of that.
You're lucky. I had to look this up, and it was very unfortunate. I may never be the same after some of the things that popped up on my computer with that search. So this is where people just go into the woods and meet up with random strangers and have sex. So I guess online they say where the place is and people just show up and have sex with each other in the woods without protection. Is it gross?
It's beyond
gross.
Isn't
that really yucky? Yeah.
Even if you're kind of a sex dog.
I mean, yeah, don't use the word dog because it just gives me bad images, flashbacks.
It doesn't appeal to me at all. Oh, my God.
It's just gross, really.
It is.
I mean, even if you were a swinger, wouldn't you want to kind of know who you're going to swing with? In the woods, it's dirty and it's just yucky.
I guess that's the draw.
Maybe, right. But because she wasn't allowed to use birth control, Maraid got pregnant by a guy when she was out dogging. And for Mick, this was all her fault, even though he told her she couldn't use birth control and he wanted to do this thing. And she was going along with it for him. So he insisted that she have an abortion because this wouldn't be his biological child. So I feel like I need to pause here and talk a little bit about this. Because we've got this guy who says he doesn't believe in birth control, he wants to have all these children. So you would think he would be someone who wouldn't believe in abortion. But that's not the case at all.
No. I wouldn't even take it that way. I mean, he's just operating on, as long as it's my kid, I want you to have as many kids as you can.
That is really a poor mentality.
Well, it's his mentality.
So that shows he has no love for her because it is her child.
Exactly.
But he's ready to throw her child away, but he wants her to have more and more of his children. Because this wouldn't be her last pregnancy either.
No, it wouldn't be.
And her self-esteem must just be down in the gutter to go along with this stuff. I mean, I'm really sad for her until the tragedy happens, and then her reaction just turns me off completely to her. And I'm sure there's some psychological basis for it, but it's just so disturbing.
Absolutely. So after he hit Maraid in the head and was witnessed dragging her outside by her hair, police were called and they went to the house to give Philpott a warning. But Maraid remained devoted to him. And she refused to leave, even when her relatives were begging her to get away. At the same time, though, Lisa Willis has become more and more fed up in this crowded house with the intermittent abuse and disrespect.
Yeah, so she was kind of growing up, getting a little self-esteem, and realizing this wasn't the greatest situation.
So Lisa told Philpott that she was taking her children to the public swimming pool, but instead she fled with them to a women's shelter. Now, Maraid was so upset when Lisa left that she took an overdose. The two women had become very close, almost like fellow hostages.
That's how I see them, like two women who were in a horrible situation together, but at least you have someone to share this whole situation with, right?
Right, but now you don't.
But now you don't, and I can imagine that was very painful for her. Because I don't care how happy she was acting on TV and things, I think she was a miserable person. Her life had to be really sucky.
More than sucky.
Yeah.
So Philpott was really upset and crying, and he drank a lot, and he took a lot of pills. But eventually he got more and more pissed off.
But can you see these two parents are not considering the six or so children that are still at home? They're just thinking about their own feelings, overdosing, taking pills, drinking. Who's taking care of the kids during this time? And what kind of impression does this give the children to see their parents behaving this way? So dangerous.
Isn't it?
It's very toxic.
Well, eventually, Philpott got more and more pissed off because he had lost the woman he claimed to love, and he also lost over £1,000 a month in benefits. That's probably the thing that hit him the most, right?
I think so. I mean, he just said horrible things about her in front of these kids.
Yeah. So he began calling the local police regularly, demanding that he be given custody of Lisa's four children. He made false claims that Lisa was making threats against him and his remaining family. He also tracked her down through her sister on Facebook and warned her that he'd have her beaten up if she went out at all or dated another man. This guy is seriously deranged.
He really is. And this is when Philpott began to plan an act of arson to frame Lisa and get custody of these children back, along with, of course, the benefits that he had lost.
Right.
And he's an idiot, right? He's an inconsiderate, stupid, for lack of a better word, idiot, right? Because this plan is terrible.
Well, this plan is doomed from the start. He's going to set fire to his house, right?
Yeah, so he can save the children and say that Lisa did it, right?
Yeah, so he's going to come off as a hero. But arson is a very tricky thing.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is like something that a 9-year-old would think would work.
Yeah. And you know, you set a fire, you don't know how it's going to spread or how rapidly it's going to spread.
Well, and who would do that with your children in a house?
An idiot.
Yeah, you're right.
So on May 11th, 2012, Philpott and Lisa were due in court to fight over custody for their 4 kids. The previous day, Philpott had called the police again and said that Lisa had threatened his children. Now, this is later proved false. In the early morning of that day, the 11th, the emergency services got a call from a hysterical Mairead. She was saying their house was on fire and that 6 children were trapped inside. Philpott was heard shouting in the background, sounding frantic and distressed.
Well, some neighbors did try to get the children and save them, but they couldn't get through. They were held back by the intense heat and the thick black smoke. This was an older house. I could imagine it wasn't really the safest as far as fires go either. There were really some toxic smoke fumes coming out of that house.
Yeah.
The fire department arrived within 4 minutes, which is really quick, but it was already too late. And all 6 kids were found in their beds, and they had all been overcome by smoke inhalation. Philpott's biological children with Mairead, 10-year-old Jade, 9-year-old John, 8-year-old Jack, 6-year-old Jesse, and 5-year-old Jaden were all dead. Mairead's older son from a previous relationship, Dwayne, who was 13, was barely alive, and he was rushed to the hospital. Now, the thing about this is Philpott didn't really try to save the kids.
No.
So you can say he didn't purposely kill these kids.
But he did nothing to try to help them.
Not really. His own hide was more important to him than the children's lives.
He posed.
Yes.
So paramedics carried all the kids into the yard and tried to resuscitate them. Philpott then broke through the crowd, kissed his dead daughter Jade, then walked away. So that was the extent of his involvement at that point. And he stayed with Mairead in a neighbor's house.
So this was looked at as very strange that the parents just walked away.
Very strange. They weren't
there grieving over their children, nothing.
Nope.
Witnesses were really surprised that they didn't want to be near their children's bodies or spend some time with Dwayne, who had barely survived the smoke and might have been the only child they would have left had he survived. The police did take the couple to see Dwayne at the hospital, but Philpott refused to enter the boy's room. He said he had to go to the custody hearing that day for his 4 children with Lisa Willis. So he thinks, well, yeah, 6 of my kids are dead, or 5 are dead and 1's dying, but I'm still going to go to court?
I got to go to court.
So what's the thought process there? Any idea? Well, just stupidity again? I mean, there has to be more to this.
No. It's very simple. He's an idiot.
Yeah.
And
a narcissist.
Well, in his mind, the importance of going to court where he could regain custody of the kids and the additional £1,000 a month trumped any feelings he might have for the dead people, the dead kids.
Who he was supposed to be very nurturing to, which is really shocking.
Well, bullshit he was nurturing. I mean, he treated his women like shit.
Right.
So he can make a play of being the doting father, but he didn't care about them any more than he cared about the mothers of the kids.
Yeah. Another part of this for me is that maybe he's more upset to think that Lisa would get away with this and maybe another man would end up raising those kids than he really is about the death of the children or actually having the children in his lives. I think it was a blow to his ego that she left him.
Certainly.
And that was the big issue with her. If he'd left her behind, that would have been fine.
Sure.
If the kids had died, probably would have been fine too.
Well, we know that was.
Yeah. But the fact that she left him with the kids, and the money, losing the money, of course, was just more than his little ego could take.
Yep.
Well, police were also quite surprised when he spent half an hour in the hospital corridor whispering to one of his friends, and this was Paul Mosley. They didn't know that Paul Mosley had had a threesome with the couple just hours earlier. Philpott also felt up Marade in the hospital hallway as Joanne was fighting for his life, and just after five of his children had died that morning.
More than gross.
So people were just really disturbed to see how this couple was acting. And at this point, I really can't have any sympathy for Marade either.
No, she seems to be kind of complicit in this, doesn't she?
Yeah, I think she's too far gone here.
Yeah.
And maybe it started out that she was a decent person, but at this point, I just don't have sympathy for her.
Right. So Duane was visited by the priest from St. George's Church and by many relatives, all of whom seemed much more concerned about his condition than his mother and stepfather were. Now, he had been sleeping on his stomach in a top bunk when the fire started, so his face wasn't burned and he looked pretty normal. But he had inhaled the thick smoke and had severe respiratory complications. He ended up on a life support machine and died 2 days later.
The bizarre behavior of Mick and Marade Philpott following the deaths of their six children included that they were having food fights in the hospital cafeteria, that they went out on shopping sprees and bought frivolous items, while people in the community were raising money for their children's funerals. They also went out singing karaoke in the pub.
Yeah, that's the first thing I would do with my kids being dead. I'd say, honey, why don't we go sing a little bit tonight?
It's really horrific, isn't it?
Jesus.
Most people would not want to live at all. Relatives who'd spoken out about this behavior in the days following the tragedy included Marade's sister, Jennifer Lobin. So Jennifer said, she is a victim of Mick, but at the end of the day, when it comes to your kids, she should have put them first. And I can totally agree with that sentiment.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, when it comes to your kids, you have to draw the line. If you want to let someone abuse you, that's horrible, and you probably need help. But if you're going to let someone abuse your kids and get your kids killed, she knew he was going to start that fire. And the fact that she went along with it makes her just as bad as he was.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can see her. He comes up with this idea. I know how we can get the kids back and get some money back. And we'll just start a little fire and we'll rescue the kids and we'll be heroes and blah, blah, blah. Didn't work.
So Jennifer also said that the couple never entered the hospital room where Duane was when he was dying. When she was asked what they were doing instead, she said they were discussing where to order Chinese food and they were complaining that the hospital was crap because it hadn't given them free food, just a room to sleep in. Now this I can really kind of relate to because when I worked as a nurse in the hospital, there were people who would complain like that.
Well, sure.
Their kids were sick, they were on the system, and they would complain that they weren't getting what they wanted. They wanted to be waited on. So I don't know where this whole sense of entitlement comes from. And of course, that's just the tip of the iceberg with these people. I mean, that's really nothing compared to what they did to the kids.
No.
But I do get really infuriated with that attitude.
Well, we don't like entitled people anyway.
No, I have nothing against helping people, but the whole entitlement thing, I don't like.
So, and as the community was working to raise funds for the family after the fire, Jennifer said that she was disgusted by the couple's behavior. She was getting phone calls every day saying they're out, they were shopping, going to restaurants. And from that moment on, I didn't want to see them anymore. The lack of respect for the kids was disgusting.
And a lot of people felt that way. So I'm really not surprised that even people close to Marade were really disgusted and fed up. Of course, they had been trying to get her away from him and to stop having babies with him for years. So I can imagine they were frustrated with that. And then when this tragedy happened, just must have been unbelievable.
Must have been. So Marie Smith, who was the mortuary manager at Darby Royal Hospital at the time, talked about how Mick Philpott appeared to be pretending to faint when he saw the children's bodies for the first time. But then she saw him later engaging in horseplay with a police officer, laughing and putting him into a headlock. And she also said that Philpott once referred to the young victims as little shits, and he requested gin when she offered him a drink of water.
I don't know why people weren't just shooting him.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you stand to be around this guy? The parents' visits were like a circus, she said. To her, it didn't quite match that he was coming in to see his children who had died, and it almost seemed like a social event
for the couple. I think that's probably a pretty good description. That's how he would view it.
Well, and yeah, I think he's a scumbag, and I can see that, although I'm very shocked that the mother of the children would behave such a way. I mean, that's really shocking to me.
Yeah, not so much.
No?
No, she's been with him a long enough time. She knows how things work. She's adopted his kind of persona.
I know, but you just wouldn't think that could overcome the mother's instinct. It's really disturbing to me.
Well, yeah, but yeah. I'm not sure she had much of a motherly instinct.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I guess not. By the time of Duane's death, investigators had found gasoline at the bottom of the stairs. So this was when the first clue came out that the fire had been deliberately started. And then, of course, they looked at Philpott right away.
Right. But it was Lisa Willis who was arrested after Philpott had made comments and suggestions that she was responsible for the fire as an act of revenge. But it was soon clear that she had no grudge against Mairead or the children, who she had actually cared for and treated as her own. So she had an alibi, ended up being quickly released, and ruled out as a suspect.
And she seemed much more upset than Mairead did about her own children.
Yeah, no kidding.
And she loved those kids. Of course, she'd taken care of them as her own for years as well. So Mick and Mairead said that they had been with their friend Paul Mosley until 1:30 a.m. when he left to return to his house. They said that they had fallen asleep in the conservatory while they were cuddling on the sofa, and they were woken up by the fire sometime after 4 a.m. They exited the house from a downstairs door. Then they found a ladder and attempted to rescue the children, who they thought were all in the back bedroom upstairs. So let's go out on a limb here and say, okay, we've decided we're going to start a fire in this house to frame the ex-girlfriend and get custody of those kids back. But then they don't even make sure that they know where the kids are?
Right.
So it's so careless.
So they might not be able to rescue them anyway.
Exactly. I just wonder, was there alcohol involved? What was going on here?
He was a pretty heavy drinker.
Yeah, he was.
So it wouldn't surprise me that alcohol was involved.
Well, and Paul Mosley was involved too, we believe.
And the other thing, they had recently varnished the stairway, which was a great accelerator for the fire.
Oh, gee, yeah, I could imagine.
So even if you're thinking, you know, we'll just start this little fire by the front door, and there'll be smoke, and we'll rescue the kids and be heroes, it could spread pretty quickly with that varnish on the walls. And it did. I mean, there was a fireball that basically flew up the stairs into the bedrooms.
And the two parents weren't upstairs near the kids either.
Nope.
This is just a complete disaster.
So at the hospital, Mick Philpott was overheard telling his wife that it wasn't meant to end like this. And in the back of a police van, he was heard asking Mairead, are we sticking to the story?
Aha. Uh-huh.
Well, that makes me suspicious, huh?
Well, police were immediately suspicious. The evidence led to the couple's arrest on May 29th. First, they were arrested for murder, but then the charges were later changed to manslaughter. How do you feel about that? I mean, I guess that's all they could do, because there was no sign that these parents wanted the children dead.
No, but I would take the stance that they should have known that setting the fire could have resulted in children's deaths.
Yes.
So I would have gone after them with murder.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the law works in England that way.
Right.
But I would think maybe negligent homicide. But whatever the case.
Yeah, if that's something you can charge with.
Yeah, we don't know.
In Great Britain. I don't know.
No. Well, in turn, those arrests brought about a chain reaction. People who knew the couple felt like they could share their suspicions with police finally. Investigators put the Philpotts up in a hotel and they bugged their room. So they were arrested, and in turn, those arrests brought about a chain reaction. People who knew them felt like they could share their suspicions now with the police. Investigators put the Philpotts up in a hotel and they bugged their room. On May 19th, just over a week after the fire, they listened as Philpott told Mairead to perform a sex act on their friend Paul Mosley. The authorities would later accuse Mosley of taking the gasoline can away from the scene of the fire. So he was in on it.
Oh, he definitely was.
They believed that Philpott was using Mairead to give Mosley sex to keep him on their side and to keep him from talking.
Well, he comes pretty cheap, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, these people are not the best people.
No, they're a bunch of idiots.
By that time, they had thoroughly investigated Philpott's background, and they knew that he had a history of reacting to things with violence and dishonesty if a woman left him. And they knew that he had a history of reacting with violence and dishonesty if a woman ever left him. And this included his attempted murder of Kim Hill.
Now, because the media was focused mainly on Mick and Mairead, Mosley was not in the public eye much. He turned out to be a father of two who was living with his long-term girlfriend Helen, and he was a longtime friend of Mick's. Both men had served prison sentences, Mosley for a robbery committed when he was in his teens. He'd recently been on sick leave for Dupuytren syndrome.
So what's that?
It's a hereditary condition that causes the fingers to curl in.
That's what Bill Nighy has.
I believe he has some form of that.
Yeah.
Now, he had always held down a job, but he'd been influenced by Philpott, who could go for weeks without a bath and who often had terrible body odor. And over time, Mosley became just as unkempt as Philpott. He was a regular visitor to the Victory Roadhouse, and sometimes he had sex with Mairead while Mick watched them. Mosley acted suspicious when he was questioned by the police, and he told friends that he could make a fortune selling his story.
Yeah, so he wasn't smart either. He was a real idiot.
They all are.
You have to remember there were other people in the neighborhood who were just heartbroken and will never get over this. They have PTSD from this. They tried to save those kids, and they couldn't. So there were adults in the area.
Oh, there sure were. But the people that are at the center of this are just so lacking in any human traits.
Traits, yeah.
I mean, it's just,
no respect for life.
No.
No. Well, this Paul Mosley had taken Mick's sons to football matches and had hung around watching TV with them, even on the night of the fire. But he seemed like he didn't care about their deaths at all. So it's just beyond me. Melissa John, the girlfriend of Mosley's nephew, said that Mosley told her he had rehearsed the fatal fire with the Philpotts weeks earlier. And she said the couple were meant to yell for help, and Mosley and Mick would then rescue the children. But for some reason, it didn't work out that way.
And meanwhile, the police and the public watched as Mairead and Mick acted indifferently to the fact that their children had been murdered. Then the Philpotts insisted on holding a press conference where they wanted to thank the public for helping them and supporting them.
So you've seen the footage from this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, I would agree with the psychologist who was watching that these tears that they were shedding weren't really tears. They weren't really crying. It was all a sham.
Yeah. Well, even the things that they said, I mean, they never asked for the arsonist or the killer or killers to be found or to give themselves up. And even Mairead, who had a sad face, would bury her head in her husband's shoulder. And sometimes they looked like they were almost grinning. Neither of them shed a tear that I could see.
There was no moisture to be seen.
No.
So, and after hearing the people had set up a fund called Catch Me When I Fall, and that had raised £15,000 for the funeral of their children, Mick asked for the money that was left over to be given him in Argos vouchers.
And from what I could find, Argos, I think, is like a store. It might be a physical store and an online store, but they're vouchers to just buy shit that he wanted to buy.
So he can buy stuff.
Yeah.
And he also asked a friend to sell the teddy bears, which had been left as tributes outside of the house.
That just makes me want to throw up.
That's even worse.
Isn't that terrible?
He said that he and Mairead would use some of the money to have a big party.
For the kids, of course, Dick. Not for them, but just for the kids. Well, this elderly couple who lived next door had spent a lot of time with the Philpott children, and they were deeply upset. Mairead used some of the money to buy new pink sneakers, and she went and showed them off to this couple and to other people in the neighborhood. And people were like, what the fuck? What is with this woman? Her children all died, and she's going out buying pink shoes and showing them to us and going out to karaoke. It's just so gross. Very upsetting.
Yeah, even worse. You ready for this?
Yeah.
So 2 weeks after the fire, locals were horrified when the Philpotts showed up at a nearby pub. Mairead sat on Mick's knee, giggling. She also went up to some youngsters, young boys who were playing pool, and ground her hips suggestively against them. The couple were wearing matching hats. They drank vodka and Jack Daniels. and Mick went on stage to sing two songs by Elvis, My Boy and Suspicious Minds. So, and everyone at the pub knew who they were and what had happened to their kids. And it was so disturbing to people that the management asked Mick and Mairead to leave. And some people were so concerned that they even called the police.
It's abhorrent behavior.
Sure is.
Investigators were able to watch their behavior, and it was recorded on the pub's CCTV cameras. So further investigation found traces of gasoline on the clothes of Mairead and Mick Philpott, as well as Paul Mosley. So the three were finally arrested, and they were charged with 6 counts of manslaughter for the children's deaths. So they did go to trial, and that began in February 2013. Some of Mick's friends said that he had been driving them to a darts match a few days before the fire when he'd gotten a call, and he told them it was someone threatening to burn down his house with the children inside. So he was setting things up.
He was.
A short time before the custody hearing, Philpott had gone to see the headmistress of the local school, and he told her that his children with Lisa would be back in his custody soon and might be starting school as soon as that following Monday. And he told the same story to several mothers at the school. He even added that he had something up his sleeve. So not subtle.
Not at all. Now, at the trial, Lisa gave evidence from behind a screen. She didn't even want to look at him, did she?
No.
She testified that Mick had bombarded her with texts and phone calls after the separation, and he had been very threatening.
Well, I think one of the other reasons why she might have been behind the screen is so she wouldn't be recognized so easily by the public.
True.
Because this was a huge story, as you can imagine.
Yeah, but she actually might come out looking okay. She escaped him.
Yes, she did. But still, who wants to be asked about it at all, right?
Right.
You want to remain anonymous if you can.
Yeah.
And then, of course, like you said, there's the threats, which I'm sure were a big part of that.
I would say very definitely.
Yeah.
So then Paul Mosley took the stand, and he said that Mick had let the kids stay up on the night of the fire to watch Britain's Got Talent. Dwayne, the eldest, had stayed up later to play pool with them. And then after all the children had gone to bed, Mosley had had sex with Mairead on the pool table. He said that he had left... Okay.
Gross.
He said that he... So I guess that's out for our sexual encounters? No pool tables?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No, especially not when friends are over.
Oh, well, we'll send them home first.
Okay. Yeah, this was her having sex with the neighbor guy. On the pool table, not even with her husband.
Right.
Not that that wouldn't be any better, really, so never mind. It's all gross.
And Mosley said that he had left the Victory Roadhouse shortly after the sexual encounter on the pool table. Then there was further testimony that Mosley had offered a relative thousands of pounds to help him leave town after the fire. Now, Mosley denied this.
I don't know where he would have gotten thousands of pounds anyway, but it could be possible because he told people a lot of things.
Yeah.
Now, Mairead, she seemed oddly confident when she took the stand. She said that she had loved her children and would never do anything to hurt them. But she was unable to explain why traces of gasoline had been found on her clothing that she was wearing that night. Mick Philpott said that he rarely washed, only splashed his face with water when he got up in the morning. So he claimed that gas on his clothing and sneakers could have been there for several weeks or even months. So, wow.
And it took the jury less than 8 hours to reach a verdict. All three were found guilty of manslaughter. The judge accepted that there had been no intention to kill the children. The couple had believed that Mick Philpott could enter an upstairs window and save them. Then he would be celebrated as a hero, and Lisa Willis would be framed for the crime of arson. But he'd been unable to knock a large enough hole in the window in order to climb through. The fire had spread pretty quickly. And created toxic gases, including cyanide, and the children had died in their beds of inhalation.
Right.
Now, okay, I already mentioned that I think you should have realized that fires are unpredictable, and there could be death.
Of course. Any adult should know this. Of course they should
have. I don't know how he's figuring that his ex-girlfriend, Lisa, would be framed.
Right, because she'd have an alibi.
Yeah, he could point the finger at her, which he tried to do, but... There's no guarantee that she's going to be convicted of arson.
No, I mean, it's just a waste of human life. These kids died for no reason. It's just so idiotic. Now, he wanted to frame Lisa and gain custody of the children, but he'd killed 6. The jury only heard of the previous convictions after the end of the trial, so that wasn't used against him. He was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum of 15 years before he becomes eligible for parole, and he showed no emotion at the trial. The judge told him he had been the driving force behind the fire and added, "Your guiding principle is what Mick Philpott wants, Mick Philpott gets." And I think that's at the core of this whole thing, is this is just a selfish, stupid, egotistical, cruel, horrible human being.
I think that's a fair assessment.
And like you said, people could say he was great with the kids, but obviously he didn't care enough about them if he did this.
No. He was great for the kids as long as it suited him.
Right, as long as he could play with them and look good. And yeah, I agree. Well, interestingly enough, as he was led away, his sister Dawn shouted, "Die, Mick, die." So even their families are just done with these people.
Yeah.
And he actually responded to her by making an obscene gesture. I'm assuming he gave her the finger, but I don't know. It was blocked out in the video footage I saw. So most of the relatives have publicly disowned him, and they've grieved for their nephews and their niece while having to live with cruel comments from people just because they share the Philpott name.
Yeah, Marie Philpott and Paul Mosley were both sentenced to 17 years in prison.
In November 2013, an appeal by Marie Philpott against the length of her sentence, not the actual verdict, was heard. The grounds of the appeal were mainly that Mairead was under the control of her husband and could not exercise a free choice in her conduct. But this appeal was dismissed.
So George Osborne, who served as Chancellor of the Exchequer under Prime Minister David Cameron from 2010 to 2016, said it was time for government and society to question whether it was appropriate for lifestyles such as the Philpotts to be funded by the taxpayer. So the shocking details of his benefit-funded lifestyle, which came out during the court case, led to allegations that Philpott sought to manipulate the welfare system by forcing women to have large numbers of children to receive state benefits. He received the equivalent of a £100,000 salary when his benefits payments were added to the wages he forced his wife and mistress to hand over to him.
But I don't think this is fair, because most people on welfare are nothing like the Philpotts. And a lot of people felt that way, like this is not something that you should use to make your case about the benefits culture. Ed Balls, the shadow counselor, said the chancellor's decision to link Philpott's crimes to the welfare state was nasty and divisive. And I agree. I mean, the welfare state really has little to do with this.
It does. I mean, I guess if you could screen everyone who's up for benefits from the state, maybe you could pick out the bad apples. But to link everything to the welfare state isn't correct.
No. I mean, this is a horror of a human being.
Yeah.
And it's a totally separate issue from people who are work shy, as they say. I mean, that's the least of his issues. Mr. Balls said that they should have a proper debate about welfare reform, but to link these benefits was really just not proper. And I agree.
Yeah. Stephen Timms, the shadow work and pension minister, said, "It's wrong to link Philpott's acts with the debate about welfare, and George Osborne should not be doing so, even implicitly." So yeah, as you said, the comparison of a violent, manipulative man with others who are dependent on government benefits is unfair.
Well, before the fire and the children's deaths, debates on Philpott's lifestyle, I think, were valid discussions. When you have working people practicing family planning so they can afford to support their families, it does seem unfair for someone like Mick Philpott and his wife to continue having children they can't afford to care for. But then when you get to the manslaughter and killing the children, it's just a whole different issue.
Exactly.
So anything else to say on this case? I mean, it's so sad.
It's a horrible case.
And I don't know if the punishment really fits the crime.
It doesn't.
No.
No.
Well, what do you think should have happened?
Well, I think Philpott should have gotten life without parole, because he's eligible for parole. Even though he's been sentenced to life in prison, he's eligible after, what, 15 years?
Yeah, he is.
So I'm giving him life without parole.
Okay, so this is Dick's court.
I'm giving Mairead and Mosley probably 40 to 50 year sentences.
Yeah.
But that's only my idea.
Okay.
Dick's court.
Yeah, well, I wasn't even sure I wanted to do this case because it wasn't a planned out murder, but just the level of neglect and the disrespect and the irresponsible actions are just as bad as murder, really. It's a terrible thing.
It certainly is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for having the discussion.
Okay. Today's show has been sponsored by ADT, Real Protection. When it comes to something as important as your family's safety, you deserve real protection from ADT. Real Protection means the nation's number one smart home security provider is there for you when you need them. Real Protection means 18,000 employees safeguarding you. No matter how you define safety, ADT is there. ADT, Real Protection. Visit ADT.com/podcast to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
The music for True Crime Brewery is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you want more TCB in your life, you can go to our website, tiegrabber.com, and join Team Tiegrabber for access to our members-only episodes. Along with this exclusive access to our large number of members-only episodes, you'll receive some gifts from us. You can also go to Patreon and become a patron to get the same benefits. This month, we're covering the murders of Sheila LaBarre, a true sociopath from nearby our old stomping grounds in New Hampshire. Other members-only episodes include Clara Harris, who drove over her husband with her Mercedes, the story of killer mom Diane Downs, and the death of Tina Watson, who went scuba diving in Australia and her husband left her under the water and she died. Some other ways for you to show your support for True Crime Brewery are following us on Twitter at Tiegrabber Pods, on Instagram, Tiegrabber Podcasts, as well as on Facebook. And you can join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions group on Facebook and get into some conversations with other true crime addicts about past cases and any crime topic. If you enjoy the show, we would love it if you take a minute to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen, because that really helps us a lot in finding new listeners for the show. So now we're going to move ahead with feedback. Remember, you can send your feedback and case suggestions to us in an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, or just tell us in your own voice by leaving a voicemail on the Leave a Voicemail link on the front page of our website. Now, the voicemails slowed down a little bit at the beginning of January, so we've extended our free t-shirt offer until the end of February. So if you have interesting comments or a case suggestion you'd like to share and you'd enjoy a free t-shirt, please leave us a voicemail. So what do we have for voicemails today?
We have three. And the first one is from Linda.
Okay.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Linda from Dallas, Texas. I just listened to your episode regarding JonBenet Ramsey, and I'm now convinced that you are correct. The perpetrator of the crime is one of her family members, if not in particular Patsy Ramsey. Up until I listened to this episode, I was not convinced that any of her family members were guilty of her murder. I do have a case suggestion. It's a rather obscure case. The victim's name is Sally Ann Blackwell. She was a Child Protective Services supervisor for the state of Texas in Victoria, Texas. Her body was found not far outside the city limits of Victoria in a field, naked and possibly raped. There were two people who were heavily investigated, the first of which was her boyfriend at the time of her murder, who was a sheriff's deputy for the County of Victoria. He ultimately sued the County of Victoria for defamation and was cleared of all charges. Ms. Blackwell had a former boyfriend by the name of Mike Grimsinger, whose son was ultimately accused of and confessed to the murder of Ms. Blackwell. The son's name was Jeffrey Grimsinger. I'm not convinced that Mr. Grimsinger was the correct party to be accused of and convicted of her murder. Coincidentally, the sheriff of Victoria County at the time of Miss Blackwell's murder was Mike Ratliff, and he was charged with and convicted of sex abuse of young men in his jail in exchange for shorter sentences and better accommodation. In a final note, I'd like to say that Victoria, Texas has a high percentage of crime compared to a low population. For a beer recommendation, any beer from Shiner breweries is wonderful. Shiner's not far from Victoria, and they have wonderful beers. I thank you for your wonderful shows, and I look forward to hearing more of them.
All right. Thanks, Linda.
Yeah, thanks. It's an interesting case. I'm going to check into that.
Yeah. I'm sorry the audio there was a little bit sketchy, but we thought it was a valuable enough voicemail that I did the best I could with it.
There's some doubts about whether he actually kidnapped and killed Ms. Blackwell. He did actually plead guilty, so he wasn't found guilty. He pled.
Was it a false confession, maybe?
Well,
or
I got to check into that.
Okay. All right.
And then the Shiner suggestion, I can tell you that I have drunk a lot of Shiner because our daughter used to live in Houston. And I've had a bunch of Shiner beers, as well as St. Arnold beers. So there's another good brewery down there. So,
okay.
Thanks, Linda.
I'm not too happy about the low population, high crime rate there.
Yeah, I don't think we'll move there, right?
No, that's too bad. We'll have to look into that too.
Yeah.
Okay. So our next voicemail is from Jennifer, and this is another case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Jennifer from Fresno, California, and I'm calling today to say how much I love your podcast. I just love the soft quality of your tone compared to some other true crime podcasts, and it's just one I always like to put on and play in the background. I have a case suggestion local to Fresno. It is Dana Ewell. That's Dana Ewell, a young man who killed his parents and his sister all for greed. It's probably one of our most famous local cases and very tragic. I'm sure Dick knows many California breweries and beers, and even Fresno has some really great little local breweries that have popped open in the last few years. Thank you so much for your podcast, and I hope to hear this on an episode soon.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Yeah, thanks. I had a few California beers in my time.
Really?
Really.
Surprised. Okay.
Well, not to keep harping on this, but the daughter who lived in Houston now lives in California. So when we visit her and the grandkids, there's plenty of California beers to try.
Well, I think she bases where she lives and her career choices on where she can find the best beers for her dad, right?
Absolutely.
So she's a good girl, right? All kids should be so kind.
She's looking out for me.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have one more voicemail?
We have one more voicemail.
Okay. And this one is from?
This is from Kat.
Kat. It's a cool name.
Hi, Dick and Jill. I really love your podcast, and I was listening to a recent one that during the feedback, you said how you sometimes like to do unsolved cases, and I have one for you. I'm originally from Indiana, and there is a recent case there from February of 2017. Two girls went out for a day hike. They were teenagers, and they never came back. They were found several days later. They had been murdered. The girls were very smart, and one of them managed to get a photograph and even a voice recording or maybe a video. The police haven't been super forthcoming with what was exactly was on the phone of the attacker. And it's just really interesting. There's been a lot of speculation, potential links to another murder in a different state, various local people. And even very recently, this last week, there was a man arrested a ways away whose mugshot looks really a lot like the police sketch of the suspect. As far as Indiana beers go, I have a few options for you. The number one suggestion I have is from a brewery in McCordsville, Indiana, called Scarlet Lane Brewing Company. It's woman-owned with a female head brewer, and the beer is the Dorian Coconut Stout. It's really good. It's a coffee coconut stout. Mm. If you want something closer to where the girls were murdered, there's People's Brewing Company of Lafayette. I would suggest their Hop Killa American IPA. As far as getting one where you guys are, though, you might be better off with the big, well-known Indiana brewery, Three Floyds. And from them, I would highly recommend their Yum Yum, which is an American pale ale, and it's super good. Again, you guys are great, and I really love listening. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Kat.
Yeah, we've looked into this case, the Delphi hikers.
Yeah, quite a few listeners have written us about this case, especially back around when it happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm always intrigued. I mean, this is almost 2 years ago that this occurred, and they allegedly, or I guess, do have some cell phone evidence. You would think it wouldn't be too difficult a task to find the perp.
Right, right.
Who knows?
Well, I remember last year at CrimeCon, they had a sketch of a suspect, and they had a lot of information on the case. So we were kind of following it back then, but I haven't kept up with it. Now, what about breweries owned by women? You don't hear a lot about that. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, well, there's some.
Yeah.
Obviously.
But the majority are men, it seems like.
Men with beards.
Yeah, that's true. True story. Okay.
But, yeah, I don't see why women couldn't do as good a job brewing as men.
Well, of course. But I'm just saying, I wonder why there aren't more.
I think there's going to be more.
I think you're right.
Time.
I think it's just a matter of time. There are more women interested in drinking beer, for sure.
Okay, now we're going to do some emails.
Okay, so who's the first email from?
First is from Augusta.
Okay. And it's a case suggestion.
It is.
All right, do you want to read this one?
Okay. Hello, Dick and Jill. My name is Augusta, and I'm from Southern Illinois. I've been listening to True Crime Brewery for a few months now, and I'm a huge fan. My first episode was the Lacey Spears case, and I've been hooked ever since. Anyway, I have a case suggestion for you. In February 1998, 16-year-old Christopher Churchill was convicted on 5 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of aggravated criminal sexual assault, and 1 count of burglary. In the February 9th, 1988 hammer slayings of his half-brother, his brother's girlfriend, and her 3 kids at their home in the village of Noble, Illinois, in the southern part of the state. Now, he told police that he had thought about killing his brother for more than a year and decided to kill the others in order to relieve stress. Churchill had played cards with the family that night and then stayed up drinking and thinking about what he would do. Christopher then bludgeoned Miss Smith, the girlfriend, and her 3 children, Jennifer 12, Corey 10, and Kenneth 6, with a hammer. This case gets close to home for me as I went to elementary school with Corey, and I remember him as a nice boy who had a lot of friends. Now, the case is particularly gruesome not only because these were hammer murderers, which are gruesome enough anyway, but Churchill also watched TV and heated up food in the microwave after he murdered the Smiths, and then he committed necrophilia with the bodies.
Oh.
Just an all-American boy. There's an episode of the show Killer Kids about this case called Push Too Far, where it was discussed how Churchill was bullied all throughout school and was seen as a social outcast. And then finally, even though I'm not a drinker, I did do some research, and I found a Southern Illinois beer for Dick. This particular beer comes from the Big Muddy Brewing Company in Murfreesboro, Illinois. It's called Backwood Monster, served in a mason jar with a picture of Bigfoot on the label. I like that.
That sounds interesting, yeah.
It's an American brown ale with a 10% ABV level.
That's a respectable level.
This sounds like it's right up my alley.
It does.
So, thank you, Augusta.
Backwood Monster, that sounds familiar. You haven't had that before?
I've had Backwood Bastard from Founders.
That's probably what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah.
So what about this crime? It almost sounds like something that would be on Monstro.
Yeah, it sounds particularly gross, doesn't it?
It does sound a little too gruesome.
So I think we'll check into that and see what we might want to do.
You know, I don't mind doing it, but it's just not something I want to go into gruesome details. And if that's the big part of it, then I'm really not up for that.
Okay.
But, I mean, I definitely appreciate the suggestion, Augusta. It's really interesting, for sure. So the next email is from Kelly, and it's a case suggestion. Kelly says, "Hi, Dick and Jill. I'm Kelly from California. I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of years. It's my go-to and makes my drives to work on my Monday mornings on Wednesdays so much more bearable. You two are relationship goals. I know you hate the praise and have heard just about all you can about your goodness, but I'll just say ditto." Well, thanks, Kelly. "I'm writing with a case suggestion from my hometown, Napa, California. Halloween 2004, there was a double murder down the street from my mother's house. I was a senior in high school at the time that the cops were searching for a murder weapon, a knife, in the ivy that grew in our front yard. There's a 48 Hours mystery episode entitled Nightmare in Napa and a Forensic Files episode titled Good as Gold about this case. Three young women lived in a home a few blocks away from my home. It was a normal Halloween night. The women passed out candy to children, prepared for the workday ahead, before going to bed for the night. Adrian Insagna was awoken in the middle of the night to hear the screams of her roommate, Leslie Ann Mazzara, a beauty queen from South Carolina. She approached Leslie's bedroom before being attacked herself. The suspect fled while the third roommate hid from the commotion, escaped in her vehicle, and called authorities. About 11 months later, the investigation discovered a lead on the suspect based on the findings of three smoked Camel Turkish Gold cigarette butts found outside the home. Within days, a man named Eric Koppel, a recent newlywed, confessed to his brother and then to police that he had killed the women in the wee hours of November 1st. Between the murders and the time of the confession, Eric had married a woman named Lily, who worked with Adrienne at the local sanitation district, the workplace of my father for more than 25 years. At the wedding, Lily had even arranged for Adrienne's mother to recite a poem for Adrienne's remembrance. In the months before the murder, Lily had called off the wedding to Koppel, who blamed Adrienne for his fiancée's cold feet. Koppel admitted that in a fit of rage and jealousy, he set out to take the life of Adrienne for consoling his wife. So Koppel was sent to spend his life in prison without parole. And during his sentencing, he expressed regret and sympathy to the victims' families, saying that he planned to take his own life, but couldn't take his secret to the grave. While Napa specializes in wine, there are many fine breweries in the area as well. However, my suggestion comes from a troubled town just south of Napa, Vallejo, California, specifically Mare Island. Mare Island once was home to a thriving naval base. My grandmother proudly worked in the cafeteria on the island for much of her life. My recommendation for you, Dick, is Mare Island Brewing Company's Hydraulic Sandwich IPA. Good beer made by good people, in my opinion. If you ever find yourselves in the Bay Area, hop on a ferry from San Francisco to Vallejo to check out the Mare Island Brewery Tap Room. So that sounds good.
It does.
So thank you very much, Kelly.
Yeah, thanks. This is a good case.
So Katie also wrote in with a case suggestion, and this is our last email. Katie says, "Hi, Jill and Dick. I found your podcast a few months ago and have enjoyed listening to them ever since. I appreciate the thorough investigative work you both do and the respectful way you speak about the victims of these stories. I would like to suggest an episode on the murder of Carrie Baker. She was a 31-year-old mother of two who was found dead in her own home. I followed Carrie's story closely because I had so much in common with her and believe many of your listeners will feel the same way. Carrie leaves behind two children who may find this podcast one day. I know you both will tell her story in a fair and respectful manner, one that honors Carrie and the imprint she left on the world. Deadly Little Secrets, The Minister, His Mistress, and a Heartless Texas Murder is a 2012 true crime book written by the nonfiction author and novelist Catherine Casey and released by HarperCollins. It's about the 2006 murder by a Baptist minister, Matt Baker, of his 31-year-old wife, Carrie Baker, and the staging of her death as a suicide. So I'm not going to read all about the case because I think we've gotten recommendations for this before.
I think we have.
Yeah.
And I think we'd like to do it.
Yes. It's a very interesting story. And I've also read some books by Catherine Casey before. She does a good job.
Yeah.
So I think this will definitely go on our list. This is the kind of case that I really enjoy doing.
Well, I do too. And this type of situation where it's a man of God, basically, commits murder.
Well, the hypocrisy of it all. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, definitely. Anything where you have the hypocrisy like that.
Always fascinated by that. Mm-hmm. How you can be a minister. I mean, well, I don't see how you can be anybody and commit murder, but.
Well, sure.
But particularly a minister.
Well, this is someone who's giving people advice on how to live a righteous life, and in the meantime, doing the most horrible of crimes.
Yeah.
So it's hard to resist a story like that.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
So thanks a lot, Katie, and thank you everyone for your voicemails and your emails.
Yes, thanks. Keep them coming.
Absolutely. So I appreciate everyone listening, and we'll see you next week at The Quiet End.
You bet. Bye.
Goodbye.